This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. This is Nate G, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this fine evening?
Good. All's well.
All right. And today we are talking about health and wellness. And in essence, the title of the show is called Quitting Your Vices. And it has to do with a couple of the questions that we got today and over the last couple of weeks about quitting the vices. Dr. Lyle, since you did your webinar with Chef AJ, the cram circuit, we've had a lot of questions on this cram circuit, and we've had questions about quitting alcohol and how to get rid of all these things. But so the questions today are about the cram circuit and quitting your vices one by one, or whether you think you should tackle them one at a time. Next question is about helping your significant other with eating these, not eating unhealthy foods, and then we've got a couple of more. But before we go on, we have a caller who's been waiting on hold patiently for the first couple of minutes of the show. So we want to welcome Marcia from New Jersey. Marcia, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing excellent. You're on
Very
with
good.
Dr. Lyle.
Hi, Dr. Lyle.
All right,
Lyle.
Marcia. Hi, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
I have a couple questions. I've suffered from chronic pain, fibromyalgia for about 4 years now. And my son has me on a raw food diet. It's been helping me a little bit. I also have diabetes. And my blood sugar still is spiking a little high. I'm on insulin. And I was wondering, eating all this fruit and doing this, will that help my diabetes too?
Okay.
Like,
well,
will
first
lower
of all,
my blood sugar.
Yeah. Okay. We'll just do a quick couple of questions here. So, the diabetes that you have, is this type 1 or type 2?
2. I've had it for about 15 years.
You had it for about what?
15 years.
For 15 years. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
What's your age, Marcia?
I'm 57.
57 years old, okay.
So
you got on a type 2 diet, a raw food diet. That's a pretty extreme diet. What's your height and weight?
5'7", about 182. 5'4".
Okay.
5'4".
About 182?
Yeah, I've gained a lot.
Yeah,
of
that diet.
I also have my thyroid removed, though. And I was always on the thin side. But after I had my thyroid taken out, I gained a lot of weight, and then I got the diabetes. But it's also hereditary, too.
Yeah, I would say, diet-wise, raw food diet, there's, usually those can work pretty well for a variety of reasons. I mean, a variety of conditions. Usually they help people. If people actually do a raw food diet that is in reasonable macronutrient balance, that means reasonable balances between fat, protein, carbohydrate, fiber, water. If they do that, people usually get pretty skinny unless they start processing their food or they start eating a lot of rich foods like nuts and so forth. So it's a little unusual to see someone hanging on to that much weight, but with a thyroid, I assume you're taking Synthroid.
Yeah, I take a lot of thyroxine.
Right.
Same thing, yeah.
Yeah, well, as far as your question goes, this is it's probably a better question for, you know, a medical professional on this specific issue, someone that knows a lot about diet. So I would recommend certainly any of the folks, the doctors at True North Health Center in Santa Rosa are exceptionally good at this side of the diet equation. In other words, being somewhat unconventional and looking to use very healthy diets in with respect to chronic diseases like this. So yeah, you've got enough moving parts in here that you're not a simple diet question. And so I more or less know what you probably ought to be doing, but your condition is just disturbing enough that I would defer this to someone who does this for a living. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right. Marcia, thank you very much for the call. We really appreciate it.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so we're going to move on to our very first question of the evening. And this has to do with your webinar, Dr. Lyle, about the cramp circuit, and then the question that you answered in the last podcast, I think it was, about alcohol. And this listener says, "Dear Dr. Lyle, I appreciate the information on the cramp circuit and quitting alcohol. And I'd like to know, if a person uses more than one of these substances, say alcohol and caffeine, and eating healthy smoking, and eating unhealthy foods and smoking, do you think they should tackle them one at a time, or in a certain order, or all of them at once? And if it's all of them at once, is there a health concern that it would be such an abrupt change to the body?"
Very good question. There's not a problem doing things all at once, and the abrupt change to the body is nothing but to the good. So your body's not going to go into anaphylactic shock because it's starting to get healthy too fast. This thing will know what to do. So that's not an issue. Now, the other issue is how difficult or easy it is to go about doing things. This person is talking about a lot of moving parts here. Now, there's two moving parts that have my little ears prick up as a clinician. So when we talk about the use of alcohol, there's two types of use of alcohol. There's normal use of alcohol, and there's alcoholism. So alcoholism is a completely different animal than normal use of alcohol. So if we're talking about a person that knows that they're drinking too much and that it's dragging down their health, et cetera, that's a different issue than someone who knows that they're an alcoholic. So obviously belongs in a different category. Another red flag is smoking. So to my way of thinking, the smoking is the number one health threat that exists. It easily trumps diet. So if I will tell people, if you are trying to make a choice between what you're going to try to change, if you're going to try to stop cigarettes, or you're going to try to work on too many things at once, and you're throw up your hands in despair because you can't do them all, your job, if you're a smoker, is to stop smoking. That is the most important thing that you could do for your health. The diet can be done later. It can be done at your leisure. The damage that the diet is doing is so long-term and so slow. It's like turning the Queen Mary. No problem. You can do it nice and slow. This is not an issue. Smoking, you needed to stop yesterday. You might have needed to stop 2 years ago to save your life. We don't know. But you need to understand that is far and away the first thing on the list. This being said, that would be independent of the notion of whether or not you are struggling with alcoholism as a problem. So if you are a smoker and drinker, then we tend to need to stop those both at once. And I'm not too worried about anybody's food. Certainly you want to encourage healthy food because people will feel better. But that is a secondary consideration. If you've got an alcohol plus a smoking problem, those things sort of counter-condition each other. They're a synergistic pair of drugs, and you want to stop them both at once, slam on the brakes, and grit your teeth and try to get through the extinction burst and the cravings to follow. So a lot of times people will come to True North Health Center and try to quit a bunch of stuff at once, and oftentimes they're very successful from doing this. And so I would actually say that sometimes the use of a modified diet, like like for example, a juice diet for 3 or 4 days, may be a way to reduce some of the cravings associated with caffeine withdrawal. I'm not sure exactly why that may be, but it looks like that may be the case. That's something that we seem to observe at True North. So anyway, that's how I look at things. If alcohol is not actually an addiction problem, then cigarettes trump all. We focus on that even at the exclusion of everything else. We white knuckle our way through the tobacco problem, and then after that, we can take on other things.
And what's really cool is the patients at True North, when they fast, the smokers that I've seen there, is they actually don't crave cigarettes. They don't crave smoking while they're fasting. And it might be because Alan locks them up in there, but
yeah,
but they do quite well.
They do very well. So if you have a person that is trying to struggle with multiple issues and they can afford it, and they can take the time, then I would certainly recommend True North Health Center and a short water fast in that facility. I think that that's one of the most effective things I've ever seen for peeling away multiple addictive processes at the same time. People can feel so much better in a week, they can't even believe it. And so that's another tool in the drawer. If you don't have that available, you can do something, a modified version at home, with take a 3-day weekend or so, 3 or 4 days, and just do a juice diet and slam the brakes on, get the cigarettes out of there, and get through the extinction burst and fight for your freedom. It's the most important thing you'll ever do for yourself when it comes to your health.
And we get that cat from wandering back home and scratching at the door.
Yeah. You got it. You got it.
It's in that example, right. Dr. Lyle, is that cat's name Clarence by any chance?
Yeah, cross-eyed lion. You got it.
Yeah.
All right.
So next question. All right. So now the question turns towards your significant others. So, dear Dr. Lyle, mm-hmm. if the love of your life doesn't take as much action as you would like to see, how do you lovingly help them? They say they're stuck and not sure how to get unstuck. I wish the action was about picking up clothes off the floor or something small, meaningless, but it's about health concerns and things that could impact both of our lives in a big way. Being overweight, healing chronic disease, exercising, eating better, and taking better care of themselves. I don't want to really follow them around waving a carrot yelling, "Are you sure you want to eat that donut when there's this nutritious carrot right there?" What do I do?
Yeah, this is a obviously a tough one. What we're talking about is we're talking about the reason why they are doing what they're doing is the reasons why everybody does everything and everything does everything, which is cost-benefit analysis. So the people are running a cost-benefit analysis, and they're running it not cerebrally on any statistical or principled basis. They're running it impressionistically. In other words, they're running it with their Stone Age brain. And their Stone Age brain can't really see the pleasure trap very easily. They're just simply following their instincts, and they're eating a bunch of rich stuff, and it always seems like it's pretty much the right decision, and to go in the other direction seems like the wrong decision. And if they in principle understand that they need to go against it, and they start to try to go against their instincts and try to do things healthfully, the problem is that they get immediate feedback that it's the wrong decision, i.e. it's not very tasty. And they also, even if they were managed to go half a day, which is a miracle for most people, to go half a day without some kind of indulgent food, what we find at the end of that half a day is a feeling of pointlessness. Like, what's the point? There's no way they can see into the future that they would do this 150 days in a row, which is what it's going to take to make a substantial impact on their morphology. So this all seems pointless. And the cost-benefit analysis, it's kind of like, if you have a credit card debt of $18,000 and you just got somebody just sent you $20 for your birthday, and you just feel like, what's the point in paying off $20 against this $18,000 debt? It's just, it doesn't feel like it's worth doing. So I'm just going to go spend the $20 and forget it. This is essentially what's happening here. And so the person is basically lost in a trap, and they don't know how to get out. Now, they may have some motivation to get out. They probably do. They certainly are aware of the prices that they're paying behind this at some level, but they also feel overwhelmed by the cost-benefit analysis. So one component of the cost-benefit analysis is the embarrassment that comes with being a failure at taking on this problem. So one of the things that we want to do is we want to, as much as possible, but to a significant degree, we want to reduce the embarrassment that comes with trying and failing. Because one of the things that they're doing is they're contemplating any time they're making changes, they're also realizing they probably will not do a very good job following through, and therefore they're going to look bad because if they make an effort, they probably won't follow through, and then they're going to look like they're weak and that they're a flake, et cetera. So it's going to be a character wrap on them. And so if they don't do a good job on any given plan, and so as a result, they can feel the scrutiny about their character, and this will stop them from even making any attempt. So I've made many discussions about this phenomenon. I call this the ego trap. The motivational system is essentially locked in an endless procrastination cycle because the person's running a cost-benefit analysis that they have more status than they probably deserve when it comes to self-discipline and conscientiousness, et cetera. So the person on the other side of the table actually, quote, believes in them, and therefore they are boxed into a situation where they had better not try, because if they really try then they fail, then they will have lost even more esteem. So what we want to do is we want to depersonalize the potential for success or failure and instead put the success or failure on the scheme, not the human. And so the notion is, like in this particular case, I mean, I would manage this in different situations depending upon the personality dynamics involved. But this person says the love of your life, okay, and that the person feels stuck. So there's discussion about this. And the person who is stuck is feeling the intimidation of making the best effort that they can and that they're likely to fail right in front of their partner who looks better and is doing better. And so they're going to lose esteem. So they feel stuck. They feel like for some magical reason or mysterious reason, they cannot get the gumption to get the motivation going. The reason why is that the bar is set too high. So the way we're going to set the bar is not to make the bar so pathetically low, like, well, gee, why don't we just start with a quarter of an apple every other day and you can add that to the pizza and, you know, et cetera. Let's put the bar there. No, that's not how we set the bar low. We set the bar low in the sense that we're going to have schemes that we're going to try. So we're going to say, listen, what we haven't found for you, what seems like it's got you stuck, is we don't have a scheme that really fits you. So we haven't had a plan that really fits you. So let's come up with a plan and give it a shot. And then if it doesn't work, no problem. So we'll try a plan for like 3 weeks, and we will see what happens. And if it turns out that it kind of falls flat on its face and that you can't maintain any momentum or behind it, that's okay. We'll sit back and we'll do a postmortem on the plan a little bit, and we'll take some time and we'll think about it, and then we'll go back and try to retool, and then somewhere down the road we'll try another plan. And we'll just keep trying plans till sooner or later we find the plan that fits you, because I got to believe that there probably is one. So it's just that it's not easy to find the right plan. So essentially, we make it not a problem of the person's character, we make it a problem of the plan. And so each plan that we have actually has the bar fairly high. And now the stance of the person that is the loving human that's trying to help is, hey, you know, maybe this will work for you, maybe it won't. Okay, but that's not a problem. Maybe, you know, and we slip in the very tiniest edge of insult. Very tiny. And I'm talking about, you got to be so smooth about this. It's got to be in your soul to be loving when you do it. The notion is going to be, well, you know, maybe this is one you can do and maybe you can't do it. Okay, so Now the person hears this and it's a challenge. And what they hear is that even though you're loving them and supporting them, you actually don't necessarily believe that they can do it. Now that's exactly where we want them. We want them a little bit insulted. We want them embarrassed that it looks like there's this problem that they can't handle. However, they can also sniff that they are loved and supported in spite of the fact that we suspect that they can't do it. It's like, hey, you might not be able to do it, but that doesn't mean that I don't think you're wonderful. You are wonderful, but I'm just not so sure that you can do this plan, but maybe you can, maybe you can't. We'll find out. We're going to give it a shot, see what happens. Now the person can feel like they've got status to gain by giving their best effort. And they don't have that much status to lose if they make a good effort and they fail. They don't have as much to lose. So we have altered the cost-benefit analysis on whether or not it's worth, quote, getting unstuck. They're not stuck in mud. They're not stuck by tar. They're not stuck by circumstances. They're stuck by a psychological process by which the cost is greater than the benefit for making the effort. And that cost is the loss of esteem from you. So what we have to do is we already have to have them lose the esteem. We have to already signal to them that we're not so sure that they can do it. If you put that vibe inside their head, now it will rock them out of the ice and will get them moving and attacking this problem. So if it turns out that they start attacking the problem and then they fail and fumble, our attitude should not be disappointment. Our attitude is, hey, you know what? This is a tough problem. You know, the people that work with this problem say that not very many people succeed. And so the game is apparently keep trying different schemes until you find one that fits you. So let's see what else we can do. And to have a cheerful, resilient, relaxed, not rushed, methodical attitude that we're just going to keep every now and then. We're going to get organized and give ourselves a little 3-week plan and take a run at it and see how we do. What we're going to try to do is get them to a place where across 3 weeks they get through some extinction bursts, they get themselves taste neuroadapted in the right direction, they get their self-esteem rolling in the right direction because they actually do 21 decent days in a row. They actually lose, 5-6 pounds behind being really diligent. And we say, hey, what do you know about that? That's pretty cool. And they get some wind at their back. And we say, well, maybe we ought to stick with this for a little while. It seems like it's got a chance, okay? And we keep them right there in this stance that we're not sure that they can do it, but looks promising. And we keep right there until, if you can get them on a roll for a couple of months, they start being a believer that this is for real, this is what they can do. They drop 20 pounds, and now suddenly it's like, hey, this is something that I could do. So this is how we change the motivational equation. All right? And that works for everything in principle, but that's how I would manage it in this particular set of circumstances.
And so a follow-up question for me is, in this type of circumstance, would you suggest the plan to them that they just kind of go cold turkey or just leave it up to them and see what they think they can do?
I would actually say that I would probably probably pull a webinar off the McDougall website, early 2016, January, a webinar I did called The Slow, Fast Way. And there's a little chart that I have there that you can make your own chart, or if that person emails me at drdouglyle@yahoo.com and asks for my little check sheet chart called Starch Targets. It's a little chart that outlines a 2 weeks at a time, a little scheme that I present in that webinar about getting on a roll. Okay, and that webinar is all about getting yourself on a roll where the expectations are down and modest, and we're attacking goals methodically, and we're trying to essentially breathe life into a self-esteem that is twisted sideways. Behind essentially giving up before we start because we don't want to lose any more status. So that's what I would do. But in this particular case, if I was the person, they might they might join together, watch this webinar, and see whether it speaks to them, and then use the search target sheet and say, hey, let's see what happens. And maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. And that needs to be the attitude. We frame this, not that this is the solution, that this is maybe the first of several attempts to try to put a scheme together.
Interesting. And so in your opinion, you only have this discussion when they admit, or in essence, they're asking for help and they're admitting that something's going on,
right,
and that they can't do it themselves.
Right. Yeah, this is there was obviously been some talk between these people about this issue, and the person who's struggling feels stuck and defeated, but they're still loved by their partner. And so this is there should, you know, it sounds like there is a dialogue on these issues, and this is how I would fashion that dialogue towards this notion of, hey, you know what? Let's keep giving it a shot, and one day maybe we'll find a scheme that works for you. And that's how I would approach it.
What would you suggest? Let's say we had this exact scenario. Well, not exact, but this scenario, except the love of the life actually doesn't think there's a problem, and is essentially, you know, addicted and is getting unhealthy, but really doesn't have any plans or doesn't really realize what they're doing.
Yeah. There's, of course, nobody's quite that oblivious. Obviously, the person, in those circumstances, it depends upon what the cost benefit is to the person who is actually in healthier circumstances, and how they feel about their partner just as they are. In other words, if your partner has habits that are frustrate you because you're worried about their long-term health, but you still find them sexually attractive, you still find them a great partner in life, then part of my attitude is, hey, don't get greedy. It's like if you're worried, you know, relax. This is hopefully you have educated them enough, and they're close enough to the evidence that they can sort of decide for themselves. Remember, it's unlikely that their life's on the line. The difference between a very healthy eater and a very sick eater is 3.6 years of life. It's not that much. Okay, so this is really about disability and quality of life, and the truth is disability and quality of life can be changed along the way. So if you are overweight, kind of struggling along, type 2 diabetes, your feet are starting to get tingly, hey, there's plenty of time. So you can change when the price seems to be high enough that the benefit seems to be worth it. So if you're in love with a person, attracted to a person, and the relationship is otherwise working, but you're frustrated that they appear to be self-destructive, my attitude is, hey, make some really healthy food that is tasty that they like and have some of it around, and otherwise don't worry about it because it's their life, and if you've got a really good intersection – that life is a rewarding one, then call it good. Don't get greedy.
Very good. Excellent. All right. So we're going to turn the compass a little bit and change topics away from the cram circuits and quitting devices and the pleasure trap. And we have a question from one of our listeners about education and why is it so difficult to be a student? So dear Dr. Lyle, want to know why is it difficult to be a student? Why does the brain give the student such great emotional stress when he or she studies? Does it have to do with the brain wanting to conserve energy by being used up by the brain? And if so, what tips would you recommend to persist in the face of this stress in any academic pursuit? In other words, the stress that your brain creates for you while you study.
All right. Well, we would obviously have to cross-examine this person to try to get what they're describing about what their problem is. But let me give several comments about studying and studying strategies that could cover. I might just happen to hit the bullseye with this specific individual, and you know, I think most of our audience is older than student age, but you know, some of them might be young enough, or they might have kids that struggle. So I will give a few minutes to this issue. Not very many people know how to study. So that's problem number one. And so let's look at what's happening. There's several broad components here. So hopefully you're motivated with the outcome. So if you're trying to get yourself to study to where there is no major outcome that's associated with success, then it's going to be hard to get your brain to focus. If there is an outcome that is important to you, that you need the GPA, you need the class, you need things for important outcomes for your life, then this is a legitimate stepping stone, and it's a test for you to execute on. And so it becomes something that you need to do, and you should do it well. You might as well. Now, how do we study? What we do is we break problems into little chunks. And so a very good way to study is to, whether it's, obviously you study for physics differently than you study for history. So what we're going to talk, if you're studying for physics, then it's clear how you do it. You have to work problems. So if we're talking about chemistry, physics, mathematics, et cetera, it's obvious that we need to understand the concepts, and then we need to do many problems. One of the things that you do is you get multiple books, for example, on the same topic, and you drill, and then if you get stuck, you get help, et cetera. That all hopefully makes sense. What we're talking about usually is copious amounts of reading material that people are supposed to read, and then they're supposed to go in for a test. And boy, does the brain get tired, and it does not want to focus, and it wants to wander off on everything else, and it's very unpleasant. Now, one of the reasons is that the person has essentially an infinite debt to the problem. They don't know when they should stop studying because they don't know when they've mastered the material to the degree that they should reasonably master the material. So the way I saw students study, and I still see students study, is that they get a book and they take a yellow highlighter and they highlight the book as they read it, and then they're going to go back and read the highlighters. That is a losing proposition. That is not how to study for a test. This is how you that's a way to study, have a bunch of anxiety, cram all the way to the end, and then go in there and get a B, okay? Now, if you happen to be brilliant, maybe you get an A, but you probably don't. That's a B way of studying if I ever saw it. So let me tell you how you do it right. What you're going to do is you're going to take the book and you're going to make an outline in your own handwriting in pen that is a facsimile of the book. So it's going to say Chapter 1, George Washington. And then you're going to read the first paragraph, and it's going to say he was born in such and such in Mount Vernon. And then you're going to write that down, but you're not going to write the whole paragraph down. You're going to write your synthesis of that paragraph. And then if there's a heading, and the heading says, the day he chopped down the cherry tree. So then you're going to have a little synopsis of that. And as you go through, the headings, you're going to put the same headings in your notes as they have in the chapter if there's big important headings. And if there's obviously anything italicized or in bold, we're going to make sure we know what those things are, and they're going to go in our notes. So at the end of the day, what we're going to have, let's suppose we have a 27-page chapter on George Washington, we're probably going to have a dozen pages of our handwritten notes, which are, of course, far few words per page than the text. So we've synthesized the text down into a facsimile of the text. And then what we're going to do, once we have that facsimile, is we're going to now write a quiz. So we're going to have Chapter 1, George Washington quiz, and it's going to look exactly like the notes that we have. And, in fact, it should be on the same amount of pages. So I wouldn't use back and front to pages. I would just use, I would just write on the front of every page. So we're going to have quiz page 1, quiz page 2. We're going to have quiz page 12. And the quizzes are going to be what we call cued recall. So it's going to say George Washington was born in, and then it will have a blank with a line that we put. So it's a cued recall. And you might even put the last, so say he was born in 1723. We might put 1 blank, blank 3. So you have to be like, God, okay, that's what it's got. It has to be 1700, so it's got to be 17-something, and that's right, it was 1723. when you make cued recalls, the brain has to fight to fill in the blanks. And when it fills in the blanks, it is massively more efficient at remembering information. So if you simply took notes, and then you, after you took the notes, you passively read over the thing, no good. If you actually made a quiz that did not have cued recall, you just ask a question, tell me about George Washington, tell me about the cherry tree, not good enough. If you make a fill in the blanks through this thing, so it's like somebody went through your notes and then they wiped out half of the words, and then you have this with little things like, well, there's three things he's famous for. You put three famous things, and you put little cues to what those three things are. And you're putting them on the same pace of the quiz place on the quiz page as the information is. So now it's going to turn out that we are going to go, when you do this, you'll find typically after you have read the text carefully and while you're reading, you've actually put the notes in your own hand, and then after you did that, you wrote a cued recall quiz. When you then go back and take the quiz the first time, you'll typically get about 50% of the material right, which is unbelievable. You have now studied vastly more intensively than anybody with a reading with a highlighter, and you're still only getting it half. So then you're going to go back a couple minutes later, and you're going to drill it again. This time you'll get about 70%. Then you're going to drill it again a couple minutes later, and this time you're going to be at about 80 or 90%, and then you're going to drill it one more time a few minutes later, and then you'll be at 100%. So in this way, what we have is we have a methodical machine for the memory system. So this is a very efficient mechanism for the human memory. So you don't want to read and highlight and take notes online, and it's so cool that, you know, they got the text there and we can block it. Forget it. Write it in your own handwriting. This forces your brain to synthesize the material and get the gist of this thing so that you've got it under your fingertips. There is nothing like teaching in order for you to learn. It forces you to learn. And by taking your own notes and synthesizing the material, it is forcing you to teach someone else, which is the person who is going to read that thing. So that's how we do it. Then we create a cued recall, and then we drill the recall. If you do this, you have such a deep structure now for how it is that this is how this information hangs together, because your own notes are now effectively a facsimile. An informational facsimile of exactly the way the guy laid out the chapter, exactly the way that he had organized everything to get his points across. So at that point, you have now absorbed in your own mind the structure of the entire of what was being communicated. And so now, when we now drill in that thing, you can now set that thing aside. If it's 4 weeks in front of the final, you can put it aside in a nice little stack. And guess what? Your brain's going to remember it. And when you come back 2 hours before that final and you pick up that sheet of paper and you do your drill, you'll be at about 50%, and 2 minutes later you'll be at 75%, and 5 minutes later at drill number three or four, you'll be at 100%. It'll all hang together beautifully. It'll all be gestalted and cross-wired. And this is a way that you can do studying a month ahead of a final that you cannot otherwise do when people cram and highlight. Okay, so this is a way to have an hour that you spend 3 weeks ago be just as efficient at memory systems as the literally 20 minutes before the final. So everybody, instead, what they do is intimidated by the enormous amount of detail that they're going to try to learn by reading this thing and highlighting it and trying to go back and remember. What they do is they wait till the last minute and they cram. That's what they try to do. And that's what everybody does. Not everybody, but that's what most people do. And as a result, most people have a mediocre job of how it is that they use their brain. And it's very stressful, okay, because you don't know when you're done. If you do it the way I'm talking about, you know when you're done. You've drilled this thing to 100%. You set it aside. Go take yourself a walk. Incidentally, frequent breaks when you're studying information of this kind is a really good idea. Because it requires time for these for the brain to essentially synthesize and crosswire and essentially cross-pollinate this information all over the head. You take breaks, and when you're done with George Washington, you take yourself a nice long break for half an hour. Then you come back, you start in Thomas Jefferson. Okay, new chapter, new stuff, etc. And just bit by bit, we set up an accretion process of memory, and you can be way ahead of the game, and it's not stressful at all to study this way. You are essentially like a mulcher. You are just putting information in there and mulching it and mulching it and mulching it and mulching it. You're a machine. I used this strategy all through my academic career. I could take a book and I could put a look at my watch, and I would read a page of the standard page of whatever the text was, and then I would multiply that by four, and that would be how long it was going to take to master the material in that book. So if it took 3 minutes a page, I would know it was going to take me 12 minutes a page. If there's 200 pages associated with the midterm, I knew that it was going to be 12 times 200, so it was going to be 2,400 minutes in order to master the material on that midterm and make sure that I would get an A. So that's how you can do it, and that's more or less what the parameters are for how the brain works.
And so, all right. does memory have to do with IQ or intelligence, or is that just a process of just your repetition?
Memory, certainly people with higher IQs tend to have better memories, but in all kinds of things. But here's the point. The point is that there's the most effective ways to utilize the memory circuits and how they work. Mm-hmm. So this is a method that is extremely efficient relative to typical study methods. And so it doesn't matter. Your intelligence is going to be mostly in play with how easy it is for you to synthesize the information and to understand it and then to get the gist of it in your own words. That's going to be the main efficiency there. The memories itself are pretty mechanical. So it has to do with these very mechanical processes, and you don't have to be brilliant to memorize a tremendous amount of material effectively.
And where were you when I was having to memorize all these muscles and nerves and arteries and veins?
Yeah, and I would have told you, you should have gone and learned Latin and Greek before you do that, mostly yeah. Latin. Yeah, that's how you do that. All right, let's go on.
All right, so our next question, this is about how to manage life as a very agreeable person. Mm-hmm. Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm a highly agreeable person, which can be a distinct disadvantage at times in my daily life. Sure. I often don't stand up for myself when I know I should, and it seems to be getting worse as I age. I'm 58. For example, I bought a product for several $1,000 paid up front and was told that it would be about a month before they could ship it, which was fine by me. 1 month became two, then three, then four, and now it's been 5 months. And the vendor seems to always have good reasons why he can't get the product to me. And I just keep agreeing to the latest delay. I finally gave him a deadline where I told him that I wanted the product or my money back. But that's weeks away. Is this agreeableness, or am I just spineless? How can I beat my genes and become more assertive? I feel weak and less than a man, but I can't seem to beat it.
Oh man, this guy's a great neighbor. Here's the problem. Whatever line of work this person's been in, it has been one where he has not dealt with a bunch of shifty people, and so he hasn't learned to defend himself. So he's been in some sort of nice guy arena where he's been insulated from some of the rough and tumble issues. We have a president who would never be in this situation. Okay, not a chance. So we can't tell what the situation is here. He may be in literally a legal and financial position of weakness, so there may not be a contract, or the vendor may be shaky enough where the vendor could just walk off with the money and then he'd have to sue the guy, and the guy's broke anyway because obviously there's some big problem with this vendor with whatever this is. My attitude was that this is a lesson that you need to learn, and it's not a matter of getting more assertive. It's about understanding the position of power. You do not want to be fronting large amounts of money in a situation where you don't have incentives for the person to deliver. It's a disaster. So everybody that has ever dealt with a contractor knows this is just a no-no. You don't pay the painter $1,000 and then have him show up, you know, 3 days from now to start painting your house. That's a mistake because he won't show up. That money is going to be at the local bar, and there will not be a painter painting your house. So this is really somebody that is agreeable and pleasant and honorable, and so they would simply expect that if they would make this deal in the way that they made it, there shouldn't be a problem. No, you need to know that there is a problem, and you don't want to put yourself in a financial slash legal position of weakness like this. So if you ever are fronting a substantial quantity of money for you, you need to make sure that you've got legal teeth and all of the incentives are pointed the right direction. So, you know, it needs to be $1,000 down and $6,000 when the thing comes in. And then if you don't meet the deadline, then that's going to happen. And so these are just very simple. This is what we call the carrot and the stick. You need to – this is particularly a problem, by the way, when you are when you're in what I call a one-move prisoner's dilemma, which is that if you can just tattle on your friend and get out of prison and there's no consequences, then you better just do it. In other words, that's a old-fashioned game theory prisoner's dilemma. And so a lot of business deals in life are potential one-move prisoner's dilemmas. Like when somebody's going to paint your house or they're going to sell you a car, they're not in it for the long term. You might say, well, sure they are. They could sell me another car. Yeah, really? That salesman's not going to be on that lot 9 years from now when you go looking for a new car. So when you are buying a car or you are buying a house or you are, you know, making some major purchase of some kind or major investment, you're restuccoing your garage, this is a one-move dilemma. And that means that the people on the other side cannot be trusted. And so that's why we have civil code. That's why we have contracts and why we have penalties and clauses, et cetera. We got to be pretty smart about that with any substantial money on the line. And one of the ways that you can do this when you are inherently vulnerable to some degree is what we call the carrot and the stick. So what we have is we have a carrot that we hang out in front of them, and we tell them not only are we going to have our house painted, but before they start, we want them to go look at our mother's house because she's going to need her house painted too. Okay? Now,
I like this idea.
Your mother is not going to have her house painted, but they don't know this. And so as a result, they paint your house honorably, and everything is on the up and up because they expect that they're going to paint your mother's house, and then it turns out there's going to be a delay, and we're going to have to think about it maybe next year. Okay? So that's how we see to it. So we need just a little more savvy. It isn't that the person is overly agreeable. It's that they're a little, like I said, insulated, slightly naive. A lot of people have not wound up in a number of situations where they've gotten burned. Some people have. Some people have been in rough and tumble business situations, and they're burned a lot, and they learn early. By the time they're 27, they're like an old marlin in the sea with 17 harpoons in their back, and they're not going to be having these problems. But many people that have worked in essentially insulated situations where they haven't had this kind of thing come up for them, they may not know this. Yeah, you got to protect yourself, positions of power, carrot and stick. At the end of the day, we don't put ourselves in that position. You are not being unreasonable by being pleasant to this person if they're in a position of power. We keep trying to be as nice as possible because we hope that we don't want to turn and have them irritated with us if we threaten and the threat is empty. If you threaten anybody, you better not be bluffing, okay? This is what I call bluff my not bluffing. We are not bluffing. So if you are going to come after somebody and you're going to cross swords with them and say, listen, I'm telling you, you're going to have to get this thing done or else, okay, you better be ready to follow through and so that they know it and they can feel it and that they are aware that you've got that option. So that sometimes is the only way to get people to play ball. All right.
Fantastic.
Go
all on, right.
See what else we got. We got time for one more.
We've got one more question. It's a pretty long question about borderline personality.
Oh, okay.
All right.
All right.
Do you want to leave that one for next week or?
Yeah, let's leave it for next week if it's a long one.
Okay.
Let's do that.
So we've got the next questions about borderline personality disorder. Then we have a couple of other questions about OCD and multiple personality. And then another one. So we'll table these and we will go over. So next week we have a on-air listener. We have a session with Dr. Lyle. So tune in next week. And then the following week, we're going to go back to the live version and we will have these questions. So keep sending them in and we love to read them. Dr. Lyle, thank you very much. Again, as always, great questions.
Pleasure.
Great answers.
Great.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.